Welcome to this week's edition of Blind Like Me. It's Phil Parr, and we have two folks on the show today. Our lady named Carol Snipke, who, I hope I pronounced her name right, is involved heavily in a project building a dollhouse. And you may say, what is interesting about that? Well, you'll find out if you keep listening to the program. We'll tell you about it. It is quite an interesting story that she tells. And also, our friend and, what would you say, perennial guest, all-time favorite guest, Dan Rossi. And let's just start with Brother Dan. And a little story from Carnegie Mellon University. Daniel, sir, you ready? Well, we Don and I kind of joke about it. if we don't have anybody, we call Dan Rossi. But then your life must be interesting enough, or we wouldn't keep calling, would we?
Yeah, that or the listeners are just that bored that they'll listen to anything.
Well, now that may be true. They listen to us, but we have you on, two or three times a year and talking about something. But then Dan Rossi, by the way, is our guest at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Carnegie Mellon must have some commitment of some sort to assisting blind people. They did this car driving across the country by computer.
Right. They don't have, or they didn't up until recently, have anything specific. But when I came here as a student, I was the first blind student they had ever had. So they really weren't exactly prepared. And over the years, it's kind of been a fallout of the type of work they do. They do a lot of robotics work here. They're very highly ranked in the world for robotics. And, teaching a robot to move around in an environment requires a lot of the same skills that a blind person might need to navigate. And so a lot of it has been fallout from there. They recently were part of a grant, a $15 million grant, not specifically for the blind, but to help the aging population and disabled population. Well, one of the big things in aging is vision loss.
Yes.
Macular degeneration. And they are starting to pick up more types of projects for vision impairments.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff has been pretty neat, and some of the people I've been working with or consulting with have been really excited about their projects and really putting some time into it.
But then there's another gentleman that we've had on a couple of times that works there in a good job. And I can't remember his name.
Dave Bercise, or Breeze.
That's right. Okay.
He's also a database guy like myself.
Yeah.
And we actually work essentially in the same group, although we don't interact a lot other than to talk about our deck building projects and house construction projects.
Yeah, because he's on the handyman list, I think, also.
He is, and he's very he's a very handy guy. I think the number of blind students here this year, I was just talking with our head of disabled student services, and it's only a couple, two or three this year coming in. But they seem to do pretty well. I mean, CMU tries to do what they can to get readers and such. But you know, it's a tough school to get through. But so they've been graduating, consistently graduating a couple of students, blind students a year. So,
well, it's a tough school to get through. It's also a tough school to get in. I mean, you have to be academically pretty astute, or you.
Yeah, it's pretty competitive. I was just talking with the vice president of enrollment, and the acceptance rate this year was 2%. So one out of 50 kids who applied got in.
I knew it was tough, but I had no idea.
It's very, very competitive.
2%.
Yeah. It also costs $40,000 a year to go here. So.
Man, they must have a huge complaints department, because you know, rich parents are calling up and going, I want my, you know.
Right.
God almighty. That would be a challenge. And in a I had no idea.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was that bad either. I mean, when I was came here, it was probably on the order of, you know, 15%. But yeah, it's gotten a lot more competitive.
So I don't know much about Carnegie Mellon. You hear about things, but do they? Is it a specialty school? I mean, do they specialize in something?
Or? Well, primarily computer science. We're you know, ranked and consistently ranked in the top three for computer science. Electrical engineering is always ranked in the top 10. Mechanical engineering is always ranked in the top 10. They actually have a pretty well-known drama department as well. Their architecture department is, I don't believe it's consistently ranked in the top 10 or anything, but it is well-known. So, yeah, robotics, definitely, they're
sure.
That's their big thing as far as a graduate level type work, and we have a big department, basically through kind of a collaboration with between Carnegie Mellon University and University of Pittsburgh, which is down the block, mm-hmm. and a lot of funding from other agencies for supercomputing. So we have these world class scale, you know, 6 teraflop supercomputers that people run and do experiments on, and it's all pretty impressive stuff.
Do they have set-asides for physically handicapped, for blind kids, or not?
Not as much as I would like, and I'm now that they've been making a big push to really expand the university and increase our research dollars and increase the size of the freshman class. And now it's getting to the point where I think they need to be probably doing a little more than what they have been to this point. So
yeah.
I'm trying to drive them in that direction.
But I was going to say, those blind kids, when you figure 1 out of 50 kids, those blind kids that have gotten there must be pretty sharp.
Exactly. They were probably, you know, top end students in high school and would make a success wherever they went.
You'd think so, yeah. It'd be that good. All right. What our subject or topic today is this. And some of you may have read about this in your or a store there, some sort of a store there. They've got a barcode reader that works with your cell phone. I'll just shut up and let you tell us talk about it.
So I was approached by a professor a year ago, interested in doing a project with their students to develop some type of product for a blind person. They originally were looking at going for a GPS system for our shuttle bus system, that would basically let you know when the shuttle bus was coming to your stop, or, you know, how far away it was, how long it would be there, whether the bus was full or not. And I thought that was an interesting project, but I kind of tossed around some other ideas with them that I thought were possibly a little more usable among the whole population.
Yeah, by the general blend.
Yeah, but,
yeah.
Exactly. So I started talking about barcode, you know, being able to go into a store and pick up any product and being able to identify it. And certainly a lot of products are easy to identify, but a lot of cans tend to look alike. And it doesn't even have to be in the store. I mean, I've had the experience in my own kitchen of grabbing a can out of the cabinet and wondering, Exactly what is this? Is this corn or is this beans?
And thinking, well, now if I open this and it isn't what I want, I've got something to put it in.
Exactly,
every blind person in the world has done that.
Oh, of course, of course. So, and I really leaned heavily on them to try to use as much existing technology, because anytime you start out and try to build your own device from scratch, it's going to be really expensive, it's going to be hard to market, because there's always the issue with limited quantities that you develop. So I said, well, look, I've got the cell phone. It has a screen reader on it. And granted, not every blind person has that cell phone and that screen reader, but it is readily available. And so we grabbed a barcode reading pen, which it's about the size of a magic marker. It's probably not the best device for this application, but it was small, and that's what we were looking for at the time. The barcode pen uses Bluetooth, which is basically a wireless connection to the cell phone.
Yeah, most of them have it now, though.
Yeah, exactly. And then they wrote some software that runs on the cell phone. And the third piece of this is there's a barcode site, a universal barcode site, where all the product barcodes, the universal product barcodes, are registered at the site. So Coke and Del Monte and Heinz. And
anything you want, really.
Yeah, I mean, not everything has a universal barcode, but all the major products do. And that's a universal barcode, so wherever you go, it's the same barcode. And so what the system does is, if you you bring up the application on your cell phone, and then you take this barcode pen and you scribble it across the product. And this is the difficult part at this point. You actually have to scribble it. You have to be able to find the barcode. After some practice, you kind of get a general idea of where they hide them on the boxes and cans and stuff. You know, like on cans, they tend to be near the seam of the label. And on boxes, they're typically on the back or on the side. And you know, boxes on the shelves are usually facing forward, so you pick it up and you turn it around. But you do have to scribble it over the barcode. And once the pen registers that it's read the barcode, it sends it to the cell phone. The cell phone looks in its local onboard cache of items. And if it finds it, it spews out the information, this is a box of Cheerios. If it doesn't find it, it then goes out to the website using, you know, wireless connectivity, and looks it up on the website, that barcode, and then sends the information that it gets back to the cell phone, where it then tells you what it is. It's a box of Cheerios, and then it puts it in its local cache, so that the next time you scan a box of Cheerios, it gets it.
That was my next question. So once you've gone to the store half dozen times, because we all tend to eat the same things, I buy the same four cereals every time we go to the store because it's the ones I like.
Right.
Then you'd have those, and you would have no problem identifying a box of those, would you?
Yeah, and you know, with the more memory that these cell phones are coming with, it's really not unlikely that you could have a pretty vast cache of items on the cell phone itself. And so I think it's a good product, because basically, you know, you wouldn't buy a cell phone and the screen reader for this. You would have a cell phone and the screen reader, so you would have to buy the barcode reading device and the software. So that could be pretty inexpensive when you compare it to something like the Identimate, which I think is $1,500. And the Identimate is static. I think it has a static database of barcodes, and then you have to update that, you know, once a year or something. Where this thing, you know, as soon as a barcode is registered with the website, and you happen to scan that product, you'll have it instantly. So we're experimenting now with different type of barcode readers, like omnidirectional barcode readers, so that you don't have to scribble the pen right on the barcode. You could just point it at the product from 2 or 3 inches away, and it should read the barcode. And so it'll be a little easier to scan. they tend to be a little bigger, so that's why we're kind of looking around for options for an omnidirectional barcode reader. The other interesting thing is that everybody's been talking about RFID tags for a long time, radio frequency ID tags, which would be really great, but nobody's, they're not really doing it at the product level yet. So they're not sticking RFID tags on every product. Some stores are doing it by the pallet. But if in the not-too-distant future they start RFID tagging all the products, then we could easily just switch out the barcode reading pen for
an RFID
reader.
You talked one time about using the camera built into the phone. Why did you abandon that idea?
Well, we only abandoned it because it was a bit of a stretch for the students who are currently working on this project. So, in theory, that is possible. Right now, the resolution of the camera on the cell phones is not that great, so it would be a little difficult. If the camera resolution gets a little better on the cell phones, and you can actually buy better lenses for some of these.
Well, you know, it will get better.
Yeah, it will. You know. And at that point, I think that would be. I mean, to me, that's the ultimate goal. You don't have to deal with a second item that you have to hold in your hand, a barcode reading pen or an omnidirectional thing. You know, you can just point your camera phone at the product.
That would be wonderful. I would.
Yeah.
You know, whoa, what a deal!
And I think we can definitely head in that direction. This was the starting point. And I think it was a good starting point. You know, it proved the concept. And now we just need to kind of develop that. And it is certainly well within the realm of possibility to have a camera phone be a barcode reader itself.
But, you know, when you check out of a store, that's how they check you out. I mean, they run it across there, it scans it, reads the barcode, and tells it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Rings it up on the cash register. So
right.
That technology, you're just adapting that
exactly.
To your pin, right?
Yep. And other, other advantages to the system is that if we can get it to work, you know, we could then talk to the local grocery store chain and say, hey, can we have access to your pricing database? So not only would, because when you scan the barcode, it just gives you what the product is, because that's general information. It's the same all over the country. But if we can link into the store's database.
Oh, man, it would tell you the price.
Exactly. It would tell you
Whoa.
The price. It could tell you if it was on sale, and it could tell you any product that they stock, regardless of whether it's universally barcoded or not.
Okay, so, you know, you 10 years ago, we didn't have anything. We didn't have any talking cell phones.
Right.
Now we got talking cell phones, so this is something that is going to happen.
It is. I think this is it's a good idea. You know, it's a solid idea. It's something that I think I would find usable. Now, I don't necessarily know that blind people are going to, once they have this in their hand, are going to run out and start grocery shopping without any assistance. But I think it's another tool, and it's certainly useful around the house. So I really don't see. I think, like I said, I think it's a good solid product, and I think we can definitely make it work and
okay.
make it work well.
That was my next question. What about if one of the problems? I don't have this problem because I'm anal retentive and I'm organized. I know where things are, but I take with a heart condition a 6 or 8 different pills a day, some in the morning, some at night, and I keep those in. I fill my pill taker every 2 weeks, so that I know, and I know where my bottles are. But it would be nice if there was a bottle sitting there, and I want to know what it was. If I could, the medicine they don't have barcode. They wouldn't have a barcode, would they?
I don't know. I don't believe so. But just like there's another system out there. I think it's the Voila system,
yeah.
where you put your own barcodes on things. And then
yeah.
you record whatever it is.
And, but it doesn't work very well.
It doesn't? No.
It's very, I have one, and it's very poor. You can get it to read sometimes, but most times it's just not even worth.
Oh, really?
Now the IDMate that Dale has, I think is very reliable and works, but like you said, it's $1,500.
Right. And so I think, we're definitely shooting for a price point, if we ever put this into production, much less than that.
Somewhere less than that.
Yeah. And there's no reason that we couldn't extend its capabilities similar to the Voila. So, you can put your own barcodes on things and then tell it what it is. So.
Or that you could tell it what it is and then it would tell you back when you, next time you scan it. Because, most blind people have someone who comes around, a sighted person who comes around once a week and helps them write checks and helps them organize their kitchen. Most people, you got to have some sight in your world. So when your sighted helper comes, get them to tell you what it is and you put it in the pen. So that would be great. It would be take the place of an ID mate.
Yep. Yeah, I think the capabilities for the system are, and what I like about it again is it's the cell phone. And especially if we can get the camera to read the barcodes, then you're literally not carrying anything you wouldn't be carrying on you already. I carry my cell phone all the time, so I wouldn't have to go home and grab the ID mate and then go out to the store. I could just go to the store because my cell phone's already in my pocket.
Now, this is being experimentally used in some campus store there.
Yeah, so there's a little store on Carnegie Mellon's campus called Entropy, and that's basically where we're doing most of our testing. I have taken it out to, the grocery store and played with it a bit. And like I said, it is a little slow and a little difficult to consistently find barcodes on every product you pick up. But like I said, that's why we're looking into omnidirectional barcode readers, which would make that part of it a lot easier.
But it will only get faster and better as the years, as time goes, as the technology improves. I'm sure there isn't, but someday this is going to be available to me.
It will.
To all people. I guess all your freshmen, students are coming in today, so they get one when they, it would be a good incentive, I guess.
Yeah, right. What we would consider a solid technology and solid system and get all the bugs worked out, because this is very developmental at this point, then we have to start jumping through the hoops to how do you spin the technology off from the university, which there are always hoops to jump through there, because the university wants, if it was developed using their resources, which it has been.
They want to be paid.
Yeah,
more money.
Exactly.
The university needs money to operate.
Right. There is a whole issue there, but we're not that at that point yet, and I'm not sure when we will be, but the project is definitely has gotten some funding, and so it's going to be an ongoing thing. This wasn't just a senior class project, and then the senior class graduates, and away the project goes. This is ongoing development, so we're definitely working toward an end goal.
And this isn't something that we wish we had. We're going to have it.
So, yeah, I think so.
In the next few years, we're going to have that. You understand that I'm always available as a beta tester.
I've got quite a few. Offers there.
I bet you have quite a few offers. Well, sir, you're on the list, and we hear from you from time to time. So, when it becomes available, and when the technology is a little farther along, we'll give you a call and talk about it again.
Definitely, I'll definitely keep you updated.
Dan Rossi from Carnegie Mellon University. Thank you, sir.
You bet.
Here's
is a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sight, here's Tim Cummings.
One of the maddening things about a cell phone is that they charge you so much for the accessories, whether it's a microphone earpiece combinations or whether it's a belt clip or whether it's a case for your phone or even an extra long life battery for your cell phone. Well, if that's the case, you should take a look at www.bargaincell.com. You can look up by phone manufacturer and phone model to see what kind of products they have for your phone. And they have some of the products that are actually made by the manufacturers for the specific phones. They also have aftermarket products. I've ordered from them and been very happy with my results. And you can get the stuff at quite a discount to the original price. I bought a microphone earpiece for my particular phone that normally retails for $20, and I got it for $10, so that's a pretty good deal. It's www.bargaincell.com. I'd give them a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. This is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sight.
There, Carol Smithke is our guest on Blind Like Me, and good morning. So you've been up since 7, huh?
Yes, I have.
And you're one of those blind people also who get occasionally their nights and days confused.
Pretty much so. I just like enjoying, you know, doing different things, and sometimes it gets in the way.
But you were up this morning on for the people playing music.
Yes, I was.
What, in one of the play it again, Sam rooms,
yep,
or what?
Sure thing.
Yeah. What kind of music were you playing?
I had Glenn Miller, a little bit of Glenn Miller.
Glenn Miller, you like that kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm. I like the big bands.
Big bands. I do too. I have the Time Life big band collection, as a matter of fact, that we get out and play sometimes. My wife doesn't care too much for it, but you know, she's a little younger than I am, so she doesn't care much for that. She enjoys rock and roll music from the 60s and 70s.
Uh-huh.
Which I don't like at all. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about your life. What is your level of vision?
I have zero vision.
Absolute none.
Right.
Born that way?
No.
What? Tell us about your life. How did you?
I went blind when I was 24, and actually I was also paralyzed at the same time.
Heavenly days. What happened?
Well, they thought it was either multiple sclerosis or encephalitis, but all the tests came out that it was negative for multiple sclerosis, so, you know, they still have no idea. I've been blind for 22 years, and I've had to learn how to walk all over again, you know, learn my motor coordinations and everything, and I also had to take care of a 4.5-year-old after I got out of the hospital.
Oh,
I was in the hospital for 7 months during this situation. And I even stopped breathing for 8 minutes.
Oh.
So, I'm lucky to be here.
So, well, you are very lucky to be here, but nobody knows what happened.
No. The reason they never knew is because the one doctor, instead of running tests and everything and taking blood work and all the what have you, when coming into a hospital, they basically thought I was faking my blindness and put me on the psychiatric floor.
They thought you were faking your blindness. What in the hell, what in the world would make them think you would, what would make them think that?
I don't know. I think they were probably going on the basis that I had lost I had a miscarriage. I was 6 months pregnant, and I think he was trying to go on the basis of I wanted to have attention, and my father said that's not what she's like. You know, she bounces back better than that. And by the time my parents got me out of there, I was totally blind and terribly paralyzed.
And no one knows to this day why either one of these conditions happened.
Right.
That is so strange.
Yeah, they still question it. And I still have nerve damage on my fingers to a point where if I would put my, finger on something hot, it would be a delayed reaction.
It may or may not actually, the signal may or may not get to your brain fast enough that it was hot.
Yes.
And that you should remove your finger.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that could be dangerous, couldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I have a friend in El Paso who has not the same thing, but he's paralyzed and no one knows why. I mean, he's not paralyzed, but he can't walk. Mm-hmm. His legs don't work anymore, and no one seems to know why. So, and you were 24 years old, and you had a four-month-old. Mm-hmm. I mean, a four-year-old.
A four-year-old, yeah.
My. Up until then, you had not thought about being blind? It had never crossed your mind that you might be blind someday?
Oh,
never?
No. I was perfectly healthy. In fact, I could swim 2 miles.
Really?
No problem, yeah. And I was perfectly healthy, and they still couldn't figure out why a perfectly healthy person would have a breakdown like that.
Suddenly go blind and become paralyzed.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, you were obviously married at this time.
Yes, I was.
To this man you're still married to?
No.
Oh, to a different man?
Yes.
Wow, what a traumatic thing. Raising your four-year-old, were you working at the time? Were you employed or not?
No, I was working seasonal at a tomato factory. And once I became blind and sick, after I came back, I had to deal with my husband at that time.
Yes.
Who wasn't real supportive. I mean, extremely. If I wore sunglasses or took my cane or my dog, it wasn't allowed.
Well, you had to do that because you had to have a way to get around.
Mm-hmm. But he wouldn't allow it. He's like, oh, as long as you have me, you don't need that stuff.
As long as you have me, you don't need that stuff.
So I just started breaking out of the norm and doing my thing, and he,
maybe we don't need him.
Yeah. Well, he turned around and he just couldn't handle it, and he walked.
Maybe we don't need him, but left you with a small child.
Yes.
Well, I'll be darned. What did you do? How did you cope? How did you make it? Did you have parents? Did you have family?
Yeah, I had supportive family. In fact, they sold their house. I sold my house, and we turned around and put everything together to get the house that I have.
To get you to some stable place. This was your birth parents, your actual parents.
Yeah, and they turned around and they got an apartment. That way, if anything happened to them, then I was already taken care of. They didn't have to worry about it.
Well, now, Rita, do you have brothers and sisters?
No, I don't.
You're an only child?
Yeah, unfortunately.
And all of a sudden, one day, you simply became paralyzed and blind at the same time?
Yeah.
And, of course, you couldn't work at the tomato factory anymore because you couldn't do the job that they hired you to do, I suppose.
Yep. Well, and then it went out of business, too, so, yeah.
Boy, that's pretty traumatic to happen to a 24-year-old. Would be traumatic to happen to anyone, but you certainly, were poorly equipped at that age to handle a thing like that, I would think.
Oh, yeah, I wasn't expecting it. I was expecting to be like the rest of my classmates, having a normal family, doing, normal things, jumping in my car, going where I wanted to, and, doing what I wanted to do, but...
Because that's what you were doing before this blind thing
mm-hmm. yep.
Came along. And did you graduate high school?
Yeah.
But you didn't do any college?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, did you?
I graduated after I went blind. I graduated with a bachelor's of science with social work.
Okay, now this is after you went blind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you lost your eyesight. You realized, I'm going to have to do something.
Right.
Your parents set you up, got you set up so that your family and home life was stable. And you decided then to go back to college.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
How did you learn Braille? How did you learn mobility skills and things?
Well, with the nerve damage, I didn't have any. I didn't have no nerves to read the Braille, so I went with a type and speak for all my and tape
okay.
for all my notes.
All right.
And my mother helped me with getting me around at first. From building to building, we had four buildings that I went to on campus, and she just showed me how to get from one building to the other. And
with a cane.
No, when I had my dog then.
Well, you had a guide dog. When you got a guide dog?
I had a pilot dog.
Uh huh.
And her name was Kelly, and the best pet was each door of the building had a different type of handle.
Oh.
So if I got disoriented and found out that I was at the wrong building, I would be able to tell which door handle it was.
Yeah, I wonder if that was done on purpose, those the different
handles.
No, they
never really realized it.
But you did.
Yeah.
So, and of course, that's one of the ways blind people cope. That's one of the ways blind people cope is by learning little things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you went and got a guide dog, a pilot dog. That's in where Columbus.
Yes.
And decided that if you were going to do anything with your life, you were going to have to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And you got a degree in what?
Bachelor's of Science for social work. And then when I ended up getting threatened at work and had one of the clients basically go off on me, and when I talked to the director about it, he was like, well, you're just on your own, you know. And I said, well, what happens if I would, you know, defend myself? And he was like, you can't defend yourself. You basically have to take it because you can't hurt a client. And I said, well, I understand that, but I said, you know, I said, this guy turned around and he was upset because he had to go through his rehabilitation and meeting, and I said he wanted to go home and watch his cartoons, and he picked up a scissors and drove it into the table 2 inches from my hand.
Drove it into the table.
Uh-huh. So I was like, okay, you know.
Now, what sort of clients were you dealing with? Were these mental, some sort of mental people? Or
Any type of disability. I was working at a Goodwill facility as a rehab, president of rehabilitation.
And so this guy didn't want to go to his orientation or go to a class or something, and he just became violent and decided he would attack you. He would.
Yeah. And I was basically sitting there, and he when he did it, I didn't flinch. Because I knew if I flinched, he had me.
Well, but you didn't see it coming.
Yep. And I didn't react even after he did it. So I just kind of like sat there and I guess what kind of helped me was while I was doing my internship, I worked at a drug and alcohol facility. And I worked with a lot of the prison inmates from one of the facilities that was not far from where I had my office. And they taught me a lot of things, and they were more understanding with my disability, the gentlemen were, than even people in my own, you know, community.
Yeah. Well, you've had quite a life for a 40-year-old lady, 42, however old you are, 40, or early 40s. You've done a lot of things. So you were in private practice at one time, or?
I was in a facility. It wasn't a private practice. It was more like a countywide. It handled five counties.
And so you decided after the guy attacked you, or it didn't really attack you, but after the guy did the little scissors thing, you quit that job.
Yeah. And then I decided to go into what I really wanted to do, and was massage therapy.
Which was massage therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what you wanted to do to begin with, which is what you were learning to do now.
Yes.
You were taking courses in that now.
Yes.
So you're going to scrap the degree, the psychology degree, and become a massage therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you can make a living doing that?
I think so. I've had a lot of compliments, and not too many of them can turn around and put their client to sleep. So I guess that's that's one of my step ups for me.
Do you put clients to sleep with massage?
Uh-huh.
Well, I've had several massages. I've never had a lady put me to sleep.
Yeah, I was told by a good friend of mine, he is like, when you get a client to fall asleep, that means that's a compliment.
In other words, you've relaxed that client to the point that they felt comfortable enough to go to sleep.
Exactly.
I would agree.
He falls asleep.
I would agree. Well, it would have been a whole lot easier to have started out as a massage therapist than to have gone through this 4 years of college that you went through to get the degree that you got.
Oh, yeah. I definitely think so, because my rehab counselor wouldn't let me go through it.
Wouldn't let you do what?
She wouldn't let me go through the massage therapy course.
Why?
Because I lived in a small community. I was also divorced. I wanted to have it based out of my home, which I had a garage that could have been renovated into my office area.
Uh-huh.
And she was like, she added two and two together with her own stereotype and said, can you imagine what people's going to think?
Well, she had a pretty good point. When you think about it, she had a pretty good point. Maybe not a valid point, but a pretty good point. Because what would people think?
The thing that I talked to my director of the school about, I told him about this, and he was like, he said you would have had your business open for 15 years. He said that was even before I started my school, he said you would have had a great clientele already built up.
Yeah, by now you would. You would be quite well established.
Mm-hmm.
Had you not gone through all these other things.
Oh, yeah.
But, of course, getting a degree is never a bad thing. I mean, having a degree is never a bad thing. Were you ever able to learn Braille at all?
Just the basics, but with it being nerve damage, I have to learn the jumbo Braille. In fact, that's what I'm going to be using to label some of the items when I start putting my dollhouse together.
Because you were the nerves in your hands, or you can't read the small Braille.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's take a break, and then we want to talk a little bit about the reason we got talking the other night is you let's take a break and we'll talk about this. We'll be back with Carol. You're going to have to do your last name again.
Snipke.
Carol Snipsky, and we'll be right back in just a minute with more Blind Like Me. Hang on.
Kelly.
You might have gathered we have a live audience today.
We have folks from all over the nation, a lot of folks from in Northeast Pennsylvania.
Good morning again. I'm Bob Bartlett.
That was November 2004. Hi, this is Phil Parr, and this November 2006, we're going to do it again. We're going to gather at the Sheridan Northeast in Houston, Texas, and have a big party. Opening ceremony Saturday morning. Cooking in the Dark with Dale Campbell and Cheryl coming Saturday afternoon. Saturday night,
lots of dancing and great live music. We'll record a live blind handyman show Sunday morning, a live blind like me show Sunday afternoon, and Sunday night more dancing and great live music. If all this sounds like fun to you, why don't you email me and I'll send you the details. My email address is phil@philpar.net. That's P-H-I-L at P-H-I-L-P-A-R-R.net. We'll see you this November in Houston.
All right, the reason Carol and I began talking, we are both members of For the People. And if you're not, you should be. It's a blind chat community where blind people get together and talk about all kinds of things. And usually, most evenings you go over there, you will find several rooms open, different rooms. I don't know exactly what some of the names of the rooms mean, but you'll find different people in different places talking about different things. And it's all right to go from room to room. It's all right to, if you find someone on that you like, you can go talk to them a while, and you can go join another group. There are all sorts of people talking almost every night. You will find people talking and possibly playing music, and these are all blind people. These are all people who have had many of the same experiences you have. Sometimes we talk about blindness issues. Sometimes we talk about life. Sometimes we just talk about silly things. And Carol got to talking about a dollhouse that you're going. I never did quite understand. You're going to build, or you have built, or just tell me the story of this. All right.
We've already started the planning already. I'm waiting for my son to come home for a couple weeks, and we're going to be cutting out the walls and getting that started.
Now, this would be the son that was 4 years old when you went blind.
Exactly. He's 26 now.
Really?
Yep. So we're going to be cutting the walls so that they slide, interlock, and, you know, they'll interlock.
Uh-huh.
So that if we want to collapse it at any time and move it someplace, we can do that.
All right.
And I'm also going to have each platform made so that there will be little tiny dowel rods where the walls will fit into so they don't move around. But
okay.
This house, the dowel house that that the plans are for, is for a replica of the house that is in my town that I have loved all my life, and I was offered to buy it after a fire, but my dad said no, it would be too much to reconstruct. And this house consists of three floors, and there's 14 rooms.
Heavens.
Six fireplaces. A wraparound on two sides front porch, which will be able to just hook on and taken off whenever.
Yeah. When you need to move.
Yes. And some of the furniture is also going to be having to be put together, and with wood glue, and they're very tiny. It's an inch scale model.
Mm-hmm. Now, this house was a real house at one time, or
yes, this is a real house that is uptown in my own hometown.
This is in your own hometown, and mm-hmm. When you as a child you loved this house.
Oh yeah.
When you were small, who lived in this house?
A Mr. and Mrs. Weaver lived in it when I was younger. And the house is about somewhere around 60 feet. We're still going to go down and meet with the couple that owns it now.
Uh-huh.
And it's around 60 feet square on each side, you know.
And you would go visit these people, and you became friends with them, and you looked at this house.
Well, in fact, yeah. The person that owns it now is one of my classmates, And I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, by all means, go ahead, take pictures. I don't care. Go right ahead. So we'll need to do pictures to get started. But to give you an example how big this is going to be, for it being, if it's like a 60-foot house on the one side, it's going to be 6 feet on one side.
Okay, so you were going to make it, say, a tenth as large as the real house.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be, in one-inch scale, so every 1 inch
okay.
is going to be a foot.
A foot, okay.
So it's also, it's 8 inches high for 8-foot ceilings.
Okay, you and your son are going to build a replica of this actual house.
Yes.
Now, have you done this before, or do you know anything about constructing? I mean, obviously you know about dowels, because you said the walls were going to be held in place by small little dowel rods.
Mm-hmm.
So you know enough to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have saws and tools and things to do this with?
Yeah, my when my father died, he left us some a table saw and a miter.
Yeah.
A miter saw, so...
that's all you need.
Yeah, and the table saw I won't mess with, but the miter saw, yeah, I won't have no problems with. But.
Now, the table saw, you don't fool with the table saw. Why?
I don't know. I just have this skittish thing about it. I don't know.
Does it scare you a little bit, the table saw?
No. I'm just going to let him, do that part. And
now you see, by him, you're talking about your son.
Yeah, my son.
Your son is going to be your help with this project.
Yeah, he'll cut out those parts. And then I also have a Dremel that I can use.
Okay.
And but we're going to have to insert all the windows, just like, a normal home.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to make them out of what?
Some of them are already made, and I picked up to tell you how expensive the front doors and the back door is. The front door was $7.99, just for the front door.
Now you made this front door? You bought?
I purchased it. Yeah.
From like a hobby shop or something.
Yeah. The reason I purchased it was because it had a kind of like a moon-shaped window in it.
And that's what the original house had?
Right now, the original house has two double doors that swings open.
Uh-huh.
And we couldn't find that in, whatever, any of the books or any of online. So we decided we'll just go with this.
Mm-hmm.
So, the top floor of the house was originally a ballroom.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. So this was a very old house.
Oh, yeah. And they told me that there was 3-foot chandeliers. And so I was doing some searching on that and found out that there is miniature chandeliers. But the only thing is once I found out how much they were, I was like, can you somebody pull me off the floor? Because it was like $130 for a chandelier.
$130 a piece?
Yeah.
Well, I guess we won't be buying too many of those, will we?
No, I figured I've seen a chandelier that my dad bought my mother once, so I'm going to go with that as a replica for it. And then just use beads. Clear crystal beads to make the chandelier.
Now, this is just something you want to do as a nostalgia project, or what is the, why are you doing this?
Well, I always wanted, my dad always wanted to make a dollhouse before, he passed away for me. And, the old goal was is to, pass it on to my grandkids.
Uh-huh.
And he never got to do it, so it's been nagging at me for the last couple months since my dad has passed away. So I decided that's what I want to do, and I've been coming up with all these ideas, what to do with it for some reason, and things have been just falling into place.
But your father only passed away a few months ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you're more or less doing this in memory of in his memory or in his honor.
Yeah. Yeah, because I've had people, well, what are you going to do with the shingles? What are you going to do about, you know, the siding and stuff? I said, well, we're planning on taking popsicle sticks.
Yeah, which I thought was a great idea, and make that kind of siding.
Yeah, and then the ends of the popsicle sticks we're going to use for the shingles. You know, kind of a fancy curve.
So if you cut off the end of the popsicle stick, you could make the little
shingles.
The shingles.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you can buy...
Oh, you can. You can buy the, you know, the square ones, or you can buy the rounded ones, but it's like $5-6 a bag.
Uh-huh.
And I figure, you know, I can do it just as cheap by making my own shingles.
Well, you can, yeah, but I'm saying you can buy these, but can you can buy popsicle sticks also, right?
Oh, yeah, you can buy them 5,000 by the boxes.
Yeah, because I've got a drawer full over here that I saved from popsicles I've eaten. And I saved them because my daddy used to, he'd be working on the radio and he'd probe around in this radio with a popsicle stick because it was, you know, you couldn't get hurt. It wouldn't pass electricity, so he would move that popsicle stick around. Mm-hmm. And the popsicle sticks are good for just if you just need a little shim. For something. People make fun of me, but I save all kinds of things.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You're going to display this house at a county fair or someone needs to see this if you're going to build it.
Yeah, we're going to do it at a county fair. We're going to, after we get it all completely finished, we're going to disassemble it and take it to a county fair and assemble it.
Uh-huh.
And so far I've even picked up a miniature baby grand piano.
And you bought this from, like you said, a hobby.
Some of it I found on eBay.
Yeah.
Yeah, some of it I found on eBay. And my mother-in-law, in fact, she had a whole box full of furniture that she was saving for a future daughter. Never appeared. So she just turned around and gave them to me.
Yeah, because the only child you had was the son that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, just for interest's sake, where will this be displayed if someone wanted to come and was lived in close to you?
It'll be in one of the bedrooms that we have.
No, I'm saying in what county fair?
It will be in Putnam County Fair.
And that's in what state?
Ohio.
Putnam County Fair in Ohio. And you plan to have this done within the next year? Within the next?
I think it's going to be taking, it might take at least 2 years by the time I even get it completely furnished and carpeted. And I even have to make the curtains for it.
It sounds like a pretty long-term project.
Yeah, we're talking like 30 windows.
And they've all got to be handmade.
Uh-huh.
And they've got to be put in so that they can be... everything has to be assembled so it can be taken apart and moved.
Right.
That's the whole point, isn't it?
That way, if my son and his wife decides to have any kids, then it'll automatically go to their kids.
It will automatically belong to them.
Yes.
Well, Carol, we're about out of time. All I can say is good luck. And people, you know, you need to pursue your dreams, and that's what you're doing, isn't it?
Yep. I've always wanted one, and I'm really shocked and surprised on I never can figure out, I mean, all the different things that goes into a dollhouse. You would be amazed.